Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. For decades, he brought a certain swag to weekend anchor news at Channel 9 and street smarts to some of the most gutsy reporting DC has ever seen. And tonight, multi-Emmy award-winning TV reporter Bruce Johnson shares his very personal story penned during retirement. Bruce joins us to talk about surviving deep waters, a legendary reporter's story of overcoming poverty, race, violence, and his mother's deepest secret. If you want to get in on this conversation and talk to Bruce Johnson, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR, or you can find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Bruce, congratulations on the book. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Brother Fisher, so good to be talking to you again, man. It's been a minute.
More
than a minute.
Yes, it has been. I have so many questions for you. Some I already know the answers to, but for the benefit of our listeners, I'm going to ask anyway. But again, congratulations on the book. A very provocative title, Surviving Deep Waters. Why Surviving Deep Waters?
You know, two pages into this book, I mean, before you actually get into the book itself, I've got a quote in there from Isaiah chapter 43, you know, verses 1 to 2, and it says, "When you go through deep waters, I'll be with you. When you go through rivers of difficulty, you will not drown." And that is just so appropriate, you know, to my life when I look back and I reflect on it. Originally, Surviving Deep Waters comes from, you know, my childhood. I grew up in Louisville's segregated West End, and there was Chickasaw Park where all of the black people gathered, you know, and we ran the gamut, you know, in terms of socioeconomics. You know, there were those of us who were poor, like my family and from the projects, but we lived not far because of legal segregation. We lived not far from the doctors, the lawyers, the funeral home directors, the bankers, the educators, the lawyers, and we all conjugated at Chickasaw Park in the West End. And at the edge of Chickasaw Park was the mighty Ohio River. And across the Ohio, we could look and see Indiana. But we would swing out on the branches, you know, right there at the water's edge, you know, at Chickasaw Park and over the Ohio River. And then when we got as high as you could get, our little tiny bodies would drop like rocks into the current. And we couldn't even swim, Harold. I mean, we would dog paddle as fast as possible back to shore so that the current didn't just take us, you know, downstream to, you know, God knows where. And that's really how we learned to swim. And that was the kind of daring group that we were. You know, we were invincible. And we just got our kicks, you know, wherever we could find them. Some of them, you know, quite innocent and some not so innocent.
It also says your mother's deepest secret. You know, just out of respect, I almost don't want to ask.
Well,
I don't want to talk about your mama, you know.
Oh, she is my hero, man. She's my hero. An incredible, incredible woman. She was raised by my great-grandmother, her grandmother, and they lived in an alley. I mean, they were so poor that they didn't bother to unpack when they got to places because they knew they were going to be evicted. And as children, you know, we'd get on the bus. My younger brother David and I, we get on the bus and we travel across town to the East End to go spend time in that alley with my great-grandmother. We called her Grandma Millie. And it was some of the best of times. We didn't have running water. You know, there was a stove in each room that heated the place up. What I like to call the powder room was on the back porch. It was outside. It was an outhouse. It was built off a porch. And so as kids, we had no idea how poor and bad off we were. There were a bunch of guys who would huddle around a wood-burning stove across the way from her house. And these were the neighborhood drunks, if you will. They were always drinking and warning us to get out of the street, you know what I mean, before we get run over. And if they were having a good day, they might give us, you know, you know, some coins or something, or some stale Hostess Twinkies or something like that. And but those were the good times for us. I mean, we really enjoyed that time. We felt protected. We felt safe. You know, it was when we went back to the projects and later on where the home itself, I mean, became violent. You know, my stepfather, he had some issues, you know, with the bottle. And I mean, you know, there was gunfire in my house. So, you know, I look back and you kind of chuckle. It's not really funny, but when you start comparing notes and talk to your friends, you realize that, you know, while your upbringing was different from the mainstream and certainly from most people, you weren't unique. It was a turbulent time, both on the outside and the inside. But, you know, there are also really good times, too. My mom worked as a domestic, and she would take me to work with her. She worked for rich white people who lived outside of Louisville. And I remember her sitting me on the sofa in the basement. She would go back and forth to do laundry and the freezer that was stuffed with food. And I'm watching shows. You know, Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best, Superman, and, you know, watching all these white heroes rescue these white women. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking that's my world. You know, I didn't know that had nothing to do with me, but I was being socialized. Okay. You know, and there was a good side to that. You know, I didn't know what I couldn't do, what I couldn't have. There was a bad side to that too. You make assumptions and you think things are in a certain order that you grow up and find out that they really aren't.
Why did you decide to get into this business? What was the thing that propelled you into TV journalism? You were in rare air, considering when you got in. There just were not many black men and virtually no black women to speak of at all.
I was the only black person in my newsroom for almost 4 years, and I started out as a desk assistant. Okay, when I was hired by a white German Catholic guy with an eighth grade education, brilliant newsman, brilliant writer, his name was Al Schottelgatti, in Cincinnati, he was expanding his news staff. You know, back then, and that was what in like 72. He was expanding his news staff back then because, like everybody else, I mean, he could hear the drum roll. I mean, you got to diversify. You got to do something. And his affirmative action program included me and these two white women. And we eventually became very good. But in my case, I didn't have any journalism experience whatsoever. I had done some radio in undergrad school and all of that and everything that led up to my showing up in Cincinnati. That makes up a couple of chapters in this book. But at any rate, so I'm there as a desk assistant, and I don't think anybody would have bet on me making it. I don't think anybody really cared that I make it. You know, I didn't have a mentor or anything. It was like in front of me, and it's like, what am I going to do with this? And so it was the only offer I had, you know, because I dropped out of undergrad school. I'd run out of money. I was practically homeless. And so I had no other place to go. So I sat there and I observed. And within a few days, the basketball coach at the University of Cincinnati, a guy by the name of Tate Baker, was fired. Big story, you know, basketball, sports, big deal in Cincinnati. And nobody, we're in the newsroom, you know, it's approaching 11 o'clock at night, and nobody could find the basketball players. And if you did, the basketball players weren't going to talk, you know, to the status quo media because they're probably upset, you know, about the firing and that sort of thing. But it dawned on me, and you can appreciate this, that some of my brothers in my fraternity, Kappa Alpha Psi, you know, were on the campus at the University of Cincinnati. And they took me in when I first got there. I stayed with them. I had no place to stay, no money for a room, hotel, that kind of thing. And so I called them, and I'm like, you know, by any chance, any of you guys know any members of the basketball team? And they're like, are you kidding? Star player on the basketball team at Kappa. You know, like three or four guys, you know, very close to the team or, you know, members of the frat. So not only do they produce these guys for me, I turned to Schottelgatti, the news director. I said, I've got some players who say, you know, they'll talk to us if we can get up there. He gave me the best photographer. We went up there, and that was my first interview, you know, set of interviews. Got on the air that night. Less than a week after that, Cincinnati had a vacancy, you know, for Archbishop. Catholic community, right? Catholic town, German Catholic, that kind of thing. And so we were trying to figure out who the new archbishop might be. So I, and this is going to take us off the path that I'm on, but I called out to the seminary. You know, my mom had put me in the seminary at age 14, 15 to begin my studies to become a priest. And it was right outside of Cincinnati. That was my first time away from home, a place she'd never been before I showed up there. So I called out there. It had been some years since I left, and just on a, you know, a whim, you know, a chance, anybody know who the new archbishop is going to be? And they were like, Bruce, great hearing from you. You know, glad to see you doing good. And yeah, we hear it's Bishop Bernard Dean out of Chicago. So I stood up in the newsroom and I said, shout out Cotty and anybody else who could hear me. Without screaming, because, you know, I had no status. So I still sitting on the desk. I said, I'm told it's Bernard Dean. And Shadow Cotty looks at me like, what? And I didn't know if the name meant something to him, but whatever. He makes a phone call because he's well-connected. I mean, to anything and everything in Cincinnati. And he gets off the phone. He looks at me and gives me a thumbs up. And he says, everybody else, we got a new lead story tonight. It's Bernard Dean. And so, man, I didn't walk out of there. I, like, sailed out of there that night. And I'm like, I can't believe they're paying us to get into people's business like this. So it was like journalism found me. And I'm telling you, it was not easy. Don't get me wrong. I had good times. It was fun times. And I learned how to break stories and how to cultivate sources. I had to learn how to write after, you know, one of the senior writers told me, you'll never be a writer, you know. I couldn't type when I first started. So, man, I started so far behind everybody else. But, Harold, I'm telling you, I didn't have a backup plan, okay? So I was staying. You know, it's just a question of, are they going to give me time? Do I have enough time to learn what I need to know? And I'm doing stories on mostly white people. I'm having to get white people who I don't know. They don't know me. I don't have any legacy. I don't have any family there. I'm having to get them to trust me with their stories. And it took time because they were accustomed to talking to the veteran senior guys, you know, the white guys who spoke the language and hung out in the same social circles and that kind of thing. But it took time, and I cultivated some skills. We did some really good work there in the time that I was there. And a lot of it is detailed, you know, in this book, in the lonely times. And it was often very, very lonely. And you know how it works. And you'd laugh at the racist jokes, you know, because you would go along to get along.
Yeah. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking to veteran journalist Bruce Johnson. He's retired and doing okay with a brand new book titled Surviving Deep Waters. If you have a question, if you have a comment, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. How did you get to D.C.?
Okay, so I'm in Cincinnati, and I went back. I started undergrad school at Kentucky State University in Frankfort. Okay, went 3 years there. First in my family, you know, to attempt to go to college, fill out an application, show up on campus. So I was there for 3 years, and there's a whole chapter in landing at this historical black, you know, college and university, and the growth, and the contacts. And, you know, that's where I started pledging. I mean, that's really where I started to really glow and realize that there's a world outside of, you know, those neighborhoods that I had been raised in. So I finished undergrad school, and Charles Cotty was very supportive. He was actually like acting like the proud father. He sent a camera to shoot me graduating, which I found to be embarrassing. You know, I thought, doesn't everybody in here have an undergrad degree? And turns out they didn't. Now Charles Cotty had an eighth grade education, but he had been a copy boy, you know, back in the day. And those jobs were reserved for white guys, you know, young white guys to come on, learn the trade, that kind of thing. And so that's all fine. So you get here by hook or crook anyway, you get here. So, and then after undergrad school, I'm like, well, that was easy enough. So I enrolled in grad school and I went to grad school full time while working full time. And I was, I've always had a backup plan. And so I'm thinking if this doesn't work out, this whole journalism and TV journalism in particular, I need something else this grad school thing doesn't work out or get me what I want. So I had applied for law school.
Well, hold that point. Hold that point, because I've got to take a break. And also, we have Kenneth calling from D.C. We're going to talk to him for just a bit as well. Kenneth, stay on the line. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking to legendary TV journalist Bruce Johnson. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. This conversation continues on Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, the app. Download it to your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety, as well as 98.3 FM. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're talking to award-winning TV reporter Bruce Johnson about his new book, Surviving Deep Waters. Bruce is in retirement now, and we are talking about his legendary career. If you have a question or a comment for him, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's hear from Kenneth calling from D.C. Kenneth, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to say thank you to Bruce for the great journalism and the work he did in Washington, D.C. The city really benefited from his work, and I want to congratulate him on his retirement.
And the sirens are calling him.
Bruce, it's Kenneth Ellerby calling, man. Congratulations. Great work, man. Really appreciate everything that you did in the city.
Thank you. Thank you. And I really appreciate the call. It means a lot. Yeah. It means a lot.
Well, Kenneth, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. So, Bruce, you were talking about getting to D.C.
Right. So I finished grad school, okay? And I knew it was time to leave Cincinnati. I mean, my plan was never to be a Cincinnati, you know, local broadcaster. I mean, my plan was always to make my way to Detroit, Chicago, New York, and certainly Washington's right there, you know, at the top of my list. And I would have come here for free. I came here for $1,500 more than I was making in Cincinnati. You know, I had a young wife. I had a young daughter at the time. And so Jim Snyder, who had built an incredible machine, had Max Robinson, Gordon Peterson, J.C. Hayward, Maureen Bunyan, Andrea Mitchell, Susan King, Mike Buchanan, Pat Collins, Bob Strickland. It's just, I mean, they were the dream team. We were called the one and only, Glenn Brenner. And so I was kind of like, if not the last piece, I was one of the final pieces, okay? He needed somebody to cover City Hall, the district building, the new majority black administration. And I had covered City Hall in Cincinnati, you know, which was a majority white, you know, administration. So I came here to cover City Hall. And, you know, I decided real quickly that got to cover it a little differently than it's been covered. You know, the newspaper guys, they'd all go down to the district building, City Hall, sit in the press room, and work their sources in the hallways and on the phone and that kind of thing. And I'm like, I'm television, dude. So, I mean, I need pictures. I need some excitement. And I needed to get out and cover people who are a lot like me, you know, African-American people, not just poor, but working poor, middle-class people who made up the fabric of the city, made up the fabric of Chocolate City. And they weren't covered nearly as much. And I don't want to pretend like they weren't covered at all until I got here. That is absolutely not true. I mean, there was great work that was being, you know, conducted, but not enough of it. And not every night and in every newscast. And so I started doing that. And then one of the first things I did was move in with a family in Anacostia, the Prices of Anacostia, we called the series. They lived on Stanton Road, you know, in public housing like I had grown up. And we spent a lot of time with that family. And through that family, we talked about the issues that people living there were confronted with. And so that's where I started. And I'd bring a lot of their issues to City Hall, to the district building, and ask them, what are you going to do about this? And I'd take the legislation, you know, that the council members would pass or the mayor's executive orders, that sort of thing. Then I'd take them to the streets and talk about how this stuff really applies. Okay, people got to live with these laws, with these regulations, and here's how this stuff is implementing and how it affects them. And of course, there's a lot of crime. You know, there's always crime. You know, in poor neighborhoods. And so I covered a lot of that, and I tried to cover as best I could, not just perpetrators of crime, but I tried to cover the victims also, and I tried to cover the people who were trying to raise their families and get their grades and get to school and get to the rec center and get to the library, get to work. And I tried to cover them also. I mean, people who reminded me of my upbringing and my mom, you know, getting off the bus, having to walk four blocks, you know, and, you know, we'd have to meet her at the bus stop to make sure she got home safely and that sort of thing. So those are the stories that I started covering. I kind of feel like I was at home in Ward 7 and 8 and parts of 6, okay? And then you come over to Ward 4. I'm spending a lot of time on 14th Street, Georgia Avenue, U Street, Petworth. You know, I know it's chic now, you know, and, you know, gentrification has changed a lot. But, I mean, you know, back when in the day, as a matter of fact, my first house I bought was right there on the border of Petworth and, you know, Manor Park, as we called it back then. So, anyway, that's what I did.
You know, and you may not remember me telling you this before, but because how old are you?
71.
You're 71. So it makes sense that you are about 13 years older than I am. And the first time I saw you in person was probably I was about 10. I think it was around 1974, maybe 75, maybe I was 11. And there was a shooting, a murder in my neighborhood in Lanham, in Woodfield Woods, and you covered it. You were one block from my house on the corner of Havelock Road and Kenmount. And I remember saying to myself, because my grandfather was a big fan of Max Robinson, of course, who was at Channel 9 at the time. And so, of course, we always had to see Channel 9 when I was growing up. And by default, we saw you. And I said, you know, that's Bruce Johnson. Of course, I was this short kid. And I just remember you were 10 feet tall to me. You know, and, you know, clean as the Board of Health, as my mother would say, with the perfect afro. And handsome as always. And I just remember saying to myself, wow. And that moment, along with earlier, the thing that really drove me to this business was Watergate. Because Watergate was everywhere. And so, but I do remember that. I mean, as if it were yesterday. But the other thing that I do remember much, much later, and you may remember this, and this was probably during the 80s when you were covering crime in the district and you were talking to some young black men about drugs. And I don't know whether it was a series or something, but I remember you and your cameraman, you were standing there in front of a young black man. He couldn't have been any older than 17 or 18. And you were just having a conversation and you said something to the effect of, are you carrying? And he lifted up his shirt and he had the biggest handgun. And at that time, I think that was such a shocking thing because the conversation was so casual, so comfortable. And then out of the blue, you just asked him, you know, was he armed? And he said he was, and he pulled out this gun. Do you remember that?
Are you kidding me? That's in the book. Okay, let me quickly give you the backstory on that, okay? It's in the chapter on crack.
Mm-hmm.
It's a chapter in this book on crack, okay? And I wanted to write a story, a chapter, not just about Rafael Edmond and the drug kingpins, and everybody knows those stories, okay? I wanted to write the story from the inside of what it was like covering those stories, okay? That kid you're talking about, my photographer, Kevin King, and I, we're out in the community, and we were coming up on sweeps period, which is, I don't know, February, probably May.
Well, which people may understand as those series that we see during the ratings period.
Yeah. These are the times when news management would give us, they would give me all the time I needed, and they wanted just something with impact, something different. Now, I always wanted impact. Every day I walked out of the newsroom, my goal was to let you not forget what I covered that day. I didn't believe in wasting viewers' time, and I wanted to do something nobody else was doing. And so on this day, I'm saying to Kevin, we're covering, you know, the violence and crack and that sort of thing. I don't need another body. I don't want to cover another dead person, a young African-American male in the street, okay? Because compassion fatigue is set in. It doesn't move the needle. People really don't care about this. And that was a big part of my frustration at that time. I wasn't making people care about this enough to the point of doing something about the drugs, the guns, the violence, the lives lost, and that sort of thing. So at any rate, we're riding around, and I spot these young guys. This is during school day, too, hanging out of this apartment building. I mean, they're hanging out hallway windows, third, fourth floor windows, and they're looking. And I knew immediately what it was. These are drug boys, okay? You know, they're looking for the cops. They're looking for customers. And I said to Kevin, pull the car over. Okay, you stay right here. And I got out, and I said to these guys, and they started coming toward me slowly. I said, I don't know if you guys ever see me on TV, but I'm the news dude. I'm not here to do police work, but I got a pretty good idea of what you're doing. And I'm not here to interrupt commerce, okay? And I said to one guy in particular, you look like you're in charge. Can I talk to you a second? And so he comes over with his guys. And I said to him, I'm trying to show how violent it is out here and why people feel they have to arm themselves. And I said to him, I've got $40 in my pocket, you know, because I know you're losing business as long as I'm standing here. I'll give you the $40 in my pocket if you will just talk to me about, and if you've got a weapon, you know, mm-hmm. can I see it? And I won't take your name, won't shoot any faces, totally anonymous, but I just want to, and I had no idea whether or not they were armed. I just assumed based on the fact I've covered this stuff before. It wouldn't be the first time I've seen a young person with a gun. So they went away and they huddled. And they came back, and the guy says, he'll do it. This guy who came up to me, and the guy you remember, couldn't have been over 13, 14 years old.
Yeah,
he was a small guy.
Yeah.
And so he says, no faces, no names. I said, absolutely right. And so I remember almost verbatim the conversation. You know, are you carrying a gun? He says, yeah. Can I see it? He's pulling it out. Where'd you get the gun? I got it from a pipehead. Where'd you pay for the gun? I gave him some crack. Are you afraid? Yeah, I'm afraid. You know, police out here, they've got guns. They're afraid, too. And eventually he says, that's it, right? He puts the gun back in. I'm like, that's it. You know, and we left.
I remember. I mean, it's amazing that, you know, when I think about you, I think about that story. Here it is in 2022. And I still that story is what, 30 years old, 35 years old?
Yeah.
I still remember that.
I came here in March 15th of 1976. If you're into Julius Caesar, it was the Ides of March, you know, and that's when the soothsayer was telling Julius Caesar, beware of the Ides of March, because he's about to be assassinated. And I said in the book, the Ides of March, it was a bad day for Julius Caesar, but it went down as the most important day of my journalism career when I came to Washington. You know, whenever I talk to you, and a lot of times when I'm up on the campus, I can't help but think, and you ask about coming to D.C., the Hanafi siege, I don't know why I can't get that word out, but I think of Maurice Williams, okay, who mm-hmm. was the youngest reporter among our group of City Hall reporters, okay, and, you know, Maurice, you know, was shot and killed during the Hanafi siege, you know, reporting for WHUR, is just stepping off a fifth floor elevator. And any one of us could have been stepping off that elevator because we were all headed to that press conference. We were pulling up in front of the building when the word went out, you know, there'd been a shooting at the district building. And all hell broke loose, you know. And the reason why that's in the book, along with the kid, you know, with the gun and all these other things, because, Harold, a lot of people either don't remember this or they never knew that these things happened. And young journalists especially, you know, and that's what, one of the reasons I wrote this book, because I want to give young journalists something that I didn't have when I first started out in Cincinnati, and that is a basis, you know, in terms of where we started and what we've done, and something has already been built for them. Like Max and JC and others built something for me. And I don't want them to forget that, because it's easy to forget that today, okay? Because they have to do it all. They have to shoot. They have to edit. They have to come up with their stories. They have to front their stories, you know, and then they got to file for digital also, and then they got to get back out there. And so they don't have time to spend looking for the kid with the gun or the story behind the shooting and how did this young person end up dead in the streets. You know, and rarely do they get the chance to spend time with the mother who they're asking, can I have a picture of your dead son? I never had a mother say to me, no, you can't, get out of here. Mm-hmm. Because I let them know early on, I'm not here to do police work. I know what police say about this. I need you to tell me something and tell my viewers something about your child, you know. And no mother could refuse that. She would instantly start talking about her boy.
You have had some personal health struggles. You had a heart attack more than 20 years ago. You have survived cancer. That has got to tell you something about your life and your work, professional, personal. What is it?
It's grace, man. You know, and that's just two things. I survived more than that. You know, and it's all in my book. You know, not gonna tell you all of that. But look, you know, there are times where you know, my wits and my experience, you know, my socialization, all that stuff, you know, benefited me and helped me, and things I learned, how to write, how to report, and that sort of thing. There are other times where my judgment wasn't where it should have been, and my skills weren't where they should have been. And when things had gotten beyond my control, life and death, I mean, and so grace and God's plan, you know, stepped in there. And I never wavered. I knew when I wasn't in charge, okay? When I was rolled into then Greater Southeast Community Hospital, you know, suffering from a heart attack, and the head of cardiology at the time, Joseph Robinson, Howard University med school trained, you know, cardiologist, is there on duty when normally he wouldn't be. And he tells me I'm going to be okay. And then Harold, on top of all that, he turns out to be my Capital brother. And to this day,
we keep saving each other.
He's still one of my best friends, and he's just an incredible man. I mean, we are very, very close, and that saved me. And he hit me up with Clotbusters, you know, and normalized me. And then they flew me by helicopter over to the Washington Hospital Center. You could still fly over the Capitol back then. And he had a team of doctors. Hector Collison, also Howard University trained, Luke Honda. I mean, the list goes on. It was like a who's who among black physicians waiting to do whatever they needed to do to keep me alive, you know, at the Washington Hospital Center. And so I underwent, you know, emergency angioplasty. Then fast forward, you know, then there was a cancer, absolutely right, in 2018. A guy by the name of Bruce Chesson, you know, at Georgetown Lombardi Center. You know, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is what I had, and he took care of me. And I never get a normal doctor. I mean, this guy played in a band, you know. It was a band of oncologists, you know. I mean, they played the House of Blues in Chicago and stuff. So just an incredible guy. And he and I are good friends to this day. And that's grace. I don't take credit for any of that. I mean, a lot better people didn't make it through these circumstances, you know. So, you know, you do what you can, try to take care of yourself, you try to exercise, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and you just put one foot in front of the other. And by the way, I'm not retired. Everybody keeps saying I'm retired. I know we use that word, but this book is like a job and a half. I'm already out there on tour doing, you know, kind of interviews and that sort of thing. And I really appreciate your time in WHUR tonight on the day that the book drops, you know. And that's the day. This is so special to me because I know how important and special this radio station is. I was on the committee, you know, when Melvin Lindsay, you know, was battling, you know, you know, HIV and AIDS and was dying, and we were trying to put together this Blue Ribbon fundraiser and tribute to him, and he didn't make it, but we held it anyway. Phyllis Hyman came to town. She was the entertainment. I mean, the list of people. I mean, that's how I met some really well-connected people in D.C., and most of us remain friends today. And only somebody like Melvin Lindsay, you know, could – Kathy Hughes, you know, could put that kind of thing together. And you know, so I go back to the days when, you know, HUR was the thing, and not just the Quiet Storm. We're tuned to HUR from the time we wake up in the morning to the time the Quiet Storm ends, you know.
Yeah.
And that was long before the rest of the country, you know, even heard the words, you know, Quiet Storm.
You know, we spoke about, you know, the kind of down and dirty, the dark side of journalism. And it's kind of funny. I mean, you were in Cincinnati and then you came to D.C. You know, I remember being in Columbus, Ohio at the NBC affiliate and doing and having a similar, you know, drug dealer photographer news experience. And you just brought back this flood of memories. I spent a lot of more time in the South covering Southern sheriffs and their work, not only balancing, you know, guys who are from central casting, you know, from, you know, Southern, as Southern sheriff's characters, but also they seemed to like me when we would cover some of the most horrific and bizarre crimes that I had ever seen. But also there were good things in my career when I was in television. What were the good things, the things that surprised you? Whether they were things that you covered, the people that you met, the best memories?
None of these things, you know, in terms of community, you know, the good things would happen. It would always be spontaneous for the most part. I mean, a lot of good things happened. They were planned. But, you know, one of the good things about what I've been able to do over the years is that when I go cover a story, and they knew this when they sent me out on a story, or when I came up with a story or came on to a story, there's no way I'm leaving there, you know, 5 minutes after, you know, the yellow tape is rolled up, because I'm seeing people that I know or people that know me or think they know me and stuff. So we got a fellowship, you know, so I'm on the corner and we're talking, and same with my photographer. I mean, that kind of stuff was so important to me, and I'm sure it was important to the people who would come up, because it was something different. It's not every day that a news crew shows up. And even if we had been there for like a murder, you know, by the time, you know, we left there, I mean, it was a little lighter. It was a little bit of hope. It was a little bit, we're all going to be okay. We've all been through a lot of stuff. And you want people to see and touch you, and you want to see and touch them. Man, I would grab people's babies and stuff, and I wasn't running for anything, but I had to get the hug from the baby or the hug from the lady who's running the community and the block and that sort of thing. That's the kind of stuff that made my days and allowed me to go back to the station and then turn around and come back the next day to cover a lot of the other stuff. You know, another thing, Harold, that a lot of people don't realize, maybe they do, Marion Barry and I just had an incredible relationship. I mean, we would be real good friends one day.
And he'd be, you know, mad as hell at you the next.
We were good friends. Yeah, and then the next day, oh, my God, he'd tell me something, and then he'd go on TV and say I'm lying. He didn't say that. And, I mean, people would be in the back of the press conference, and I'm asking him the tough question, okay? And so it might be about drug activity or whatever. And he's got, you know, Catfish Mayfield and his friends in the back. And every time I would ask a tough question, they would start saying stuff like, Bruce, I think that question's out of line. I don't think that's necessary. And I'm like, is this the news press conference or is it their press conference? I mean, and so that would take the press conference in a whole different direction. So I say all that to say, Marion Barry understood, just like when he came to D.C. and he captured this town, because he knew how to do things that a lot of people who had been born and bred in this southern town that at one time had been a sleepy southern town. And, you know, there had been the socioeconomic divide even among the black communities and that sort of thing. And then here comes Marion Barry, who comes in and just blows over, you know, the political establishment and wins everything. Not once, not twice, not three times. Four times he's elected. He's elected mayor, you know, coming out of prison. My father-in-law, who had never voted for Marion Barry before, voted for Marion Barry after he had been arrested for smoking crack because he didn't like the fact the FBI had set him up and had gotten a, you know, a former girlfriend. And my father-in-law, you know, God bless him, he's no longer with us. He said to me, you know, if you're going to grab, you know, a man's weakness and you're going to use that, you know, then we're all in trouble. We're all vulnerable. You know, they'll find whatever weakness. And so I wasn't surprised when at his funeral, and Marion Barry planned his own funeral, that he wanted me to speak, because we had a lot of private conversations. I mean, in the beginning, in the middle, in the end. One of the things I taught Marion is that, look, if you're going to tell me something, you know, that I want to report, you don't want to report it. You just want to have a personal conversation. You need to say in the beginning, this is off the record. Because he would tell me some incredible stuff and then try to say afterwards, that was off the record. I'm like, no, it wasn't.
<You know? laughs> No, it wasn't.
He told me one time, I haven't paid my taxes and I'm being investigated, you know, by the FBI. And I'm like, what? So that's like page one. And this is after, minutes earlier, he had held a press conference to just chastise the council for cutting funds to a mental health program in Southeast. And as I'm leaving, he says, come here, I got something to tell you. And he tells me about the taxes. And I shared that at the funeral because, I mean, that's the kind of relationship we had. But, you know, an incredible individual. My chapter on Marion Barry and me, it started out, it was 70 pages. I had to cut it down quite a bit. But it's still, I read it, and it's a phenomenal read. This, you know, the people who just arrive in Washington have no idea why this guy has a statue in front of City Hall,
yeah,
Wilson Building. And I will hold them in check immediately and dare them to find a local figure who had a bigger footprint on D.C. And I will challenge them, you know, to give me a day if I need them to go find their local politician, their quote hero, who doesn't have, you know, some shortcomings, you know, some mistakes, you know, in his resume and that sort of thing.
Yes,
anybody still hating Marion Barry? I mean, it's their issue.
I remember, you know, leaving here in 91, and, you know, going into, you know, television, you know, in Florida and Alabama and in Ohio, and people would talk about Marion Barry, but, you know, they were on the outside looking in. And in his defense, I would always say, you have no idea who this man is.
I flip it over to the people who voted for him. I said, so I don't really try to explain Marion's actions, because I think some of his actions are very hard to explain.
And not always the best, certainly.
Yeah. But I talk about the people who voted for him. You know, the people who voted for Marion Barry weren't naive. You know, they voted for Marion Barry for the same reason other people vote for their politicians. Marion Barry was delivering, okay? He was delivering to his constituency jobs, opportunity, level the playing field. I mean, Marion Barry helped build up not just the middle class in Washington, but, you know, he built up the middle class in Prince George's County. Two people work for the D.C. government. You put your incomes together, you're making six figures, and you're able to move to Prince George's County. And now those people have children and grandchildren, you know, with roots in the Prince George's County and still call D.C. home. So, you know, my thing is just tell the whole story about Marion Barry, you know, and that's all I ask. And that happens too many times with our stories.
Well, Bruce, stand by. The floor director says you have 90 seconds. What's your legacy?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not retired. I'm an author. This book has taken up a lot of time. I formed a business, the Bruce Johnson Group, where I do communications consulting. I'm spending a lot of time with young journalists, you know, mentees, and because I want them right. You know, they got to fix what's wrong, the misinformation and the mistrust and the hate and all these other things. They got to fix this. And corporations now run newsrooms and stuff. And so they're going to have to make it work in a different kind of environment. But I'm confident They're real smart. They're real sharp. They know the technology. They've got the skills. They're going to do well.
Yeah, I heard the news today that the parent company for Channel 9, was it Tegna?
Tegna.
Being sold.
Yeah.
Yeah. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah.
Bruce Johnson, thank you so much for talking to us. And congratulations to you, man. I'm going to call you. Look, I want a book. I want a signed copy in red Kappa ink.
With your income, you have about 10 copies.
Don't get that. But I will. I am more than willing to contribute to support a brother in that regard. You need an audio book. I want the audio book. That's what I really want too.
Bruce, yeah, that's what my son says. I'm not gonna buy the book. You got an audio book, and I'm like, you got to be kidding.
I'll do both. Bruce Johnson, again, congratulations. Thanks for talking to us. Stay healthy, man.
Absolutely. Thank you, brother.
That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, February 22nd. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.